Okay, we're getting back into the venue of Choshim Mishpat. So I wanted to speak today about Hilchos HaShutfin and Halacha, laws of partnerships. There's a lot to cover. Obviously, it's a whole section of Shulchan Aruch that deals with the laws of Shutfin, and we're not going to go through every single nook and cranny and every single sip and nuance of the laws of Shutfin, but just to give a little bit of an overview, because there are cases that come into the Beis Din on a semi-regular basis, regarding partners who have a falling out, regarding a question of how should partnership assets be divided, regarding what are the responsibilities of partners of Shutfin towards each other. And all of these questions have a precedent, have some sort of a basis for discussion in the Sugyos in the Gemara and in the Shulchan Aruch and in the Poskim. So I thought maybe we could discuss just some of the few salient points regarding partnerships. There are two different types of partnerships, as Rav Schachter likes to mention. There's a voluntary partnership where there are people who decide they're going to go into a business together. They're going to sell widgets together. When I was in law school, everybody was in the widget business. We didn't know what widgets were, but then we discovered it was a made-up word. I remember one of the students turned to me and said, "What exactly is a widget? All the law professors talk about selling widgets." They decide that they're going to go into the widget business together. They're going to go into the clothing business together. They're going to buy houses. And they're going to do rehabs and try to upgrade the houses and then sell them for a profit. They're going to go into the diamond business together. Many, many different types of partnerships that people go into. And sometimes you have a partner who gives most of the money, and then there's another partner who gives their expertise, that they're a financial wizard, and they're very good at managing money. And the default principle in halacha is that other than the capital that's put in to buy the principal assets, which would be divided according to the specific contributions of the partners, in terms of the eventual profits that are made from the business, it would be assumed that it would be 50-50. If there were three partners, there would be it would be split. Everybody would get one-third unless it was stipulated otherwise. So one very important principle that all the posts can talk about is whatever the rules are that you want to apply, it should be very, very explicit. If you're not very, very explicit about it, then the next thing that we would look at is the minhag ha-sochrim. What is the normal course of customary dealing in a particular industry in terms of when partnerships are created? But if it's not clear that there is an industry standard or an industry custom, and there isn't a very clear partnership agreement that outlines very clearly exactly how the partnership responsibilities and privileges are going to be allocated, so then you look at the halakhic sources and you would follow the halakha of exactly how the different partnership rules would operate. There is a machlokas, a three-way machlokas between the Rambam and the Raibin and the Hagos Maimonius as to how a partnership gets created in the first place. The Rambam says that you need to have actual assets, that if the partners don't buy actual assets, and they just say, whatever assets we're going to buy, we're going to split all the profits, whatever transactions we're going to conclude between the two of us, the three of us, we're going to split all the profits, but there was nothing tangible that was actually acquired by anybody. So even if you made a kinyan, even if everybody lifts up handkerchiefs and they're making kinyanim left and right and they're signing documents left and right, according to the Rambam, it would not create any kind of a binding partnership. Maybe if a signed document was recognized by the Minhag HaMedina, it would be binding as a kinyan situkta, a kinyan that would be recognized based on the customs of the place where you live. But otherwise, from a purely halakhic perspective, the kinyan doesn't work altogether, according to the Rambam. According to the Ravid, it does work even when the people obligate themselves towards each other. This is the Rambam in the Ravid in Hilchos Shluchim v'Shutfin Perek Dalet Halacha Beis. It would work according to the Ravid based on the fact that people can obligate their handiwork towards each other. Even if you haven't acquired an asset yet, but you just talk about how you're going to do work for a particular business. You're going to do work in terms of the high-tech industry, you're going to do work in terms of raising capital for a hedge fund or something of that sort. Just the commitment that you're going to put your own physical labor into the endeavor is considered to be a binding commitment the same way that a person can sell themselves to be an Eved Ivri. A person, so not that you're actually selling yourself to be an Eved Ivri, because we have a principle, Kalibine Yisrael Abadim, Lo Abadim, Lo Abadim. You're not allowed to make yourself into an Eved, but based on the same principle that a person can sell themselves, can sell himself as an Eved, so too a person can pledge that they're going to dedicate and devote all of their efforts and all of their physical labor towards a joint enterprise with somebody else. That's the opinion of the Ravid. And then there's the opinion of the Hagos Maimonides, that when you have two people who both are making mutual covenants and promises towards each other, think about a husband and wife who are about to get married and the in-laws who are making all kinds of commitments about how much they're going to furnish, who's going to supply the apartment, and who's going to pay some money to help them get on their feet the first year of their marriage and so forth. We say, hein hein adram ha-nitnim ba-amira, that these are things that can be acquired, where people can obligate themselves with words alone, even if there's no kinyan whatsoever. So here as well, the fact that there are mutual covenants and promises, like what we talk about, mutual consideration that the parties are making towards each other, that each one is going to devote their own efforts for the benefit of the other party. So that's considered to be a strong enough binding commitment, even without a Maisa Kinyan. Even if they just say the words to each other and they don't pick up a handkerchief or do a Maisa Kinyan altogether, that's the principle of Agav Detzaisi Adadi Maknu. That because of the fact that they're each getting a mutual benefit, that's considered to be good enough. So the Ramah quotes this third opinion as well, when the Ramah codifies these different approaches in Siman Kuf Ayin Vav Sif Gimel, and the Vilna Gaon seems to say that this has a good precedent in a number of different Gemaras. There's one Gemara in Bava Kamma on Daf Kuf Tezayin Amud Beis that talks about if I have a bunch of donkey drivers. I have donkey drivers that are in a caravan, and they make a covenant with each other that all the donkey drivers are going to commit. Then if one of them loses their donkey, then they're going to purchase another donkey for that person. As long as their donkey died through natural causes. If the person loses their donkey because they were negligent, that's what we call bekusya. If they were bekusya in mamid, then we're not going, then nobody's making a commitment that a derelict donkey driver who's always losing his donkeys because he's not taking good care of his donkeys, they're not going to keep on supplying him with a new donkey. But otherwise, this is just, a commitment they're making towards each other. It's not based on a kinyan, it's based on the fact that there's a mutual benefit that they're all getting. Why is that? Because they take turns watching the caravan. And if a person knows that they have their own donkey to watch, so they're going to watch everybody else's donkey much more carefully. So let's say that one of the donkey drivers says that, well, if I lose my donkey, I don't want a new donkey. I just want the money. A donkey's worth, $1,000. I want the $1,000 rather than the donkey. So he doesn't get to say that. Ain't showman low. We don't pay attention to him because he's not going to watch everybody else's donkey. The whole idea is that we're giving him a donkey so that he's going to watch everybody else's donkeys very carefully, the same way he's going to watch his own donkey. But if he doesn't have a donkey to watch, so then he's not going to do as good a job. So the Gemara says, well, that's obvious. So we say, no, lo tzrika d'isli chama harina. Even if, let's say, he had two donkeys, now he's saying, I lost my second donkey. My second donkey died. Don't pay me for the second donkey. Just give me money, and I'm watching my first donkey anyway. So we say, no, you'll do a better job if you have two donkeys to watch, and if you have one donkey to watch. So we see, says the Vilna Gaon, that there are all kinds of stipulations that can be made that are considered to be binding upon all of the parties because they're in a group together and they're getting mutual benefits. Or he quotes the Gemara in Baba Basra that talks about Ha'achin Shechalku Begoral, that you have a bunch of brothers that inherited property from their father, and there are three different parcels of land, and they're trying to figure out who's going to get which parcel. They decide they're going to divide it based on a lot. They're going to draw lots. So let's say there were two brothers. So one draws a lot it turns out that a particular parcel falls out in his portion. So that means automatically the other brother, and he didn't even draw a lot yet, the other portion, parcel of land automatically comes out in his portion. So why is this considered to be binding? The second brother didn't even draw a lot. He didn't do anything. But now it's considered like, no, he can't go back. That he already received as a kinyan. He received an absolute acquisition. The other parcel of land. So the Gemara says that it's based upon this principle of B'hau hana, based on the hana, the tzaisi lahadadi, that they have made a mutual agreement that this is how they're going to divide the land, so that creates a kinyan. That because of the fact that there is sort of a mutual agreement that this is how they're going to be able to figure out who gets which piece of land, so that agreement by itself is considered to be binding. And finally, he quotes the Tosefta on the 11th parak of Baba Metzia, that says that the Bnei Ha'ir, the Bil Nagon, everything that he quotes is Bechulei Bechulei, so you have to, you know, sort of look it up to see what the words actually say. Mm-hmm. But he quotes the Tosefta in Baba Metzia, Bechem Tosefta Roshayim Bechulei, so that Tosefta is saying that the Bnei Ha'ir, the people of the city, are all in some sort of a partnership with each other, and because they're all getting mutual benefits from their joint efforts, so they can make certain rules and regulations about, for example, what the minimum wage is going to be in that city, the Skar HaPoalim, how much are you going to pay for the workers in that city. They can make these types of enactments, the Midos, what are the proper weights and measurements and the proper fashion for checking people's weights and measurements so that you'll have an orderly society. And that's something which is considered to be binding upon all the people in the city. So this bespeaks another type of partnership that really is implied by the sources that Rosh Hashanah talks about, and that is, in addition to what to a voluntary partnership, like these donkey drivers getting together, or the artisans and the craftsmen and the people who are selling real estate getting together, sometimes you have involuntary partnerships. You have this case where brothers inherit together, so they didn't necessarily contract to go into partnership with each other, but they happen to become partners. Or you have people who just live in a city. They didn't necessarily say, I want to be partners with everyone in the city, but by virtue of living in the city, you are submitting yourself to the rules of that city, where you're going to be bound by the rules that are articulated by the majority of residents in the city. And that is a different type of partnership. That's what we call a partnership bal korcho. And there are certain distinctions between voluntary partnerships and a partnership bal korcho, a partnership which is kind of imposed upon you based on your circumstances and the fact that you have to get along with everybody. So, for example, there's a principle that if you're in a city, for example, and or you're in a community, and it's beneficial for the members of the community to have certain types of things that the Torah says that people should have. Like we should have a base knesset, you should have a shul in a community, or you should have a mikvah in the community, you should have a shliach tzibur, you should have a chazan who knows how to daven, who could be motzi people for the davening, could blow the shofar in the community. So then the halacha is that even if I just have one person who says I want a shul, and the majority of people say I don't want a shul, as long as the thing that they're asking for is something which is a legitimate Torah thing that a city, that a people are supposed to have, then the minority has the right to compel the majority to build a base of Knesset, or to enact security measures so that the city is going to be safe, to make sure that you have a security guard, to make sure that you have police and so forth. You look in Sur Zion. Sur Zion talks about it's Choshim Shulchan Aruch Choshim Mishpat Hilchos Shukim B'Kaka Siman Kuf Sama Gimel Sif Aleph says Kofin Bnei Ayir Zed says the people of a city can compel each other Afilo Miud Kofin and Samarubim, even the minority have the right to compel the majority to build certain safety features that every single city needs, like Lasos Choma, to build the city, Gosayim Uvriach La'ir, Libnos Lam Basic Nesses, and similarly to make sure that there is a Basic Nesses. And the Rama says, and this is true with respect to all of the needs of the city, including hiring a skiris chazan l'bnei ha'ir, including hiring a chazan, including hiring a rav. That's the issue that the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah discuss in Siman Nun Gimel that I have in sources Hay and Vav. But then when it comes to other things, if you look at about five lines down, let's say it's not one of these things that's an absolute imperative for the city to have in terms of a shul, in terms of security and protection, but other things, other types of rules and regulations that they just can't make up their minds about. At all the board meetings, everybody's screaming at each other and you can't, you know, figure out what are you supposed to do. So how do you figure that out? So you're supposed to have some sort of a democratic system. You get together all the people who are paying taxes. Everybody should vote. Everybody should vote l'shem shemayim. You get a vote if you're paying taxes. You're not paying taxes, you don't get a vote. But if you're paying your dues, so then you get a vote. If you're paying your membership dues, right? But and then you follow the majority. Well, where do we get this idea that you follow the majority? So the Vilna Gaon, in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, quotes from the Gemara in Sanhedrin Chof Tesem and Aleph. What does it say in Sanhedrin Chof Tesem and Aleph? It talks about if I have a bezdin, everything comes back to bezdin. If I have a bezdin, and I have a bezdin made up of three dayanim, and two dayanim say that Reuven wins and Shimon loses. So then the halacha is that Reuven wins. If two dayanim say that Shimon wins and Reuven loses, then the halacha is that Shimon wins. Why is that? Because we have a pasuk in the Torah, as Rashi quotes in the Gemara over there in Sanhedrin, Achrei Rabim Lahatos, meaning that Achrei Rabim Lahatos is not only a principle with respect to dayanim deciding cases according to the Vilna Gaon, but it's a principle with respect to partnership law. If I have partnerships and I have a group of partners, So then you follow majority vote. If I have two partners, so then you look at whatever the halacha says that a partner has a right to insist upon. The halacha says that a partner has a right to insist upon something, so even though that partner is not the majority, they get to win. The example that Rosh Hefta gives about a partner where you don't have a majority rule is when you have a husband and a wife. A husband and a wife, so by definition, you don't have a majority. You have a bezdin of two. It's a bezdin chatzuf, right? You have a husband and a wife. So really, he doesn't mention this, but the machriya is a kadosh baruch hu, because they have shlosha shufim, right? So the machriya is a kadosh baruch hu. So if one of them says an opinion that they want something that's in accordance with what a kadosh baruch hu wants, so then they automatically win. That's my own formulation. So that's the Gemara in Ksuvos. Murti Adem Shnayas at the end of Masechus Ksuvos and Daf Kuf Yud says that if a husband says, I want to live in Eretz Yisrael, and the wife says, I don't want to live there, so the husband wins. I mean, he can divorce her and not have to pay the Ksuvah. The wife says, I want to go to Eretz Yisrael. The husband says, I don't want to go to Eretz Yisrael. So the wife wins. So she's entitled to insist upon a divorce and collect the Ksuvah. So these are the same principles that we would follow with respect to every single partnership, except this partnership, as we said, it's a little bit different because it wasn't necessarily that the people knew that they were entering into a partnership. But you enter into a city, so you automatically are bound by the rules of that city, which are going to follow the majority of the vote. So you could have the majority of people elect certain officials and agree that they're going to be bound by the decisions of those officials. And that's the way that it works. So Rav Shechter quoted that this tshuva, the Igros Moshe, in Choshen Mishpat, Chelek Aleph, Siman Mem, that talks about my own Alter Haim, where I grew up, in Muncie. This was a tshuva from Tavshin Yud Tes. So it goes back, 63 years ago, something like that, before I was born. And Muncie was just at that point being developed. It was this little, small, rural, hip town. And the question was, there were some other towns, you know, adjacent to Muncie, at Spring Valley, whatever you had, you know, certain other places. Muncie was just the beginning. And the question was whether the people who lived there could be compelled to pay money towards the building of a mikvah, towards the building of a baked classes. What if they didn't want to? So Moshe said, what do you mean? If you're there, you're part of this partnership. You're part of the B'nai Ha'ir, whether you like it or not. We have rules that the B'nai Ha'ir have the right to compel. They have the right to compel certain things. So sometimes the rules regarding a voluntary partnership are going to be a little bit different from the rules regarding an involuntary partnership. But for the most part, that is going to just have to do with the fact that you might be surprised that you didn't know that you're going to be bound by, you know, all these rules and all these decisions. Well, if you enter into a business partnership, so you're going in with your eyes open that you know you're going to be bound by what the other partners decide and by majority vote and things of that variety. Yes.
First of all, going back to the donkey drivers. When one of the drivers is watching the other donkey, he's doing it for benefit. Isn't he a shomer sacher? And if he's a paid shomer at that point, how does this relationship of the partnership either augment or vitiate his liability as a paid shomer?
So as a general rule, we say that the partners are considered to be shomer sacher for each other. That they have a heightened level of responsibility because they have fiduciary duties towards each other, that so they're getting benefits, and they have a high level of responsibility.
If I'm a paid shomer, I don't need a separate partnership agreement. If I'm a paid shomer and damage happens, the Torah already tells me what I have to do there. I don't need an outside partnership agreement to give me those duties.
No, this could be an onus over here. I can make a deal. I can make an agreement among the partners that even if my donkey died, the other partners would not be responsible, even as Shel Misaka, they wouldn't be responsible if some sort of an onus happened to my donkey. But they can make an agreement between themselves.
Because
it's in everybody's interest that we're going to have this heightened level of responsibility towards each other, because we're all going to benefit in the end. So everybody's going to be bound by it. So there's
Second question. In the DAF and Miguel in the last couple of days, it's been talking about the rights to buy and sell a shul and what a community can do. Do these dinim of becoming a shutaf of baalim, I guess, are these the halachot that would apply to those gemaras right now talking about, for example, when Miguel says that if somebody leaves a town but one person wants a shul and the different permutations that the Mishnah, are these the
Yeah, this will be related. This is right. related
they
to that whole
sugya. These halachot to figure out how to carry out.
Yeah. There are a lot of halachos, but these would be included in those discussions. I think so, yeah. For example, if you look in Source Yud Beis, there's a comment by the Griz, by Revelvola Soloveitchik, the Briskarab, where he talks about how you can have different types of rules that apply to different types of shutfin. And as a general rule, we say that shutfin can't do smicha on an animal at the same time. If shutfin bring an animal together, let's say they bring a korban shlamim together, you're supposed to do smicha. So we say that they can't do smicha at the same time because it'll be like a chatzitza. Each person's hands will be a chatzitza in the other person's hands. But we see that in Parshas Tetzaveh, during the miluim, that when Aaron and his sons brought a korban, so they all did smicha bebasachas. They did smicha at the same time. So he says, why is that? Weren't they considered to be shutfin? So he says that it's a different type of shutfin. These were, they were appointed by a Kodesh Baruch Hu to serve as Kohanim. It wasn't like they agreed that they're going to buy a korban together. They were told by a Kodesh Baruch Hu, you have to, bring this korban together. So they were shutfin baal korchum. Shutfin baal korchum, therefore they had a different din. They're considered like one person. They're not like regular shutfin. They're considered to be like one person. And therefore, there would be no chatzitza if they did smicha at the same time. And the same thing he says with respect to the tenufa, to the waving of the animals. Normally, if shutfin bring an animal, so the tenufa can't be done one tenufa after another because it says tenufa and not tenufot. So therefore, if you had shutfin that would bring an animal and they had to do tenufa, then the tenufa could only be done by one person on behalf of everybody else. But in the case of Avon and Ranav, it was different because of the fact that it was a different type of shutfah. So these are, examples of how it would be different. Or, for example, Rashi says that when it comes to Maiser Behema, so as a general rule, Maiser Behema is only brought if you own the animal by yourself. But if you own the animal by shutfah, so then Rashi says that based on the Mishnah, that you would not be obligated in Maaseh Behema. Shutfin are not obligated in Maaseh Behema. But he says that if they didn't voluntarily become Shutfin, there were some children, there were some sons, and the father died, and then they inherited the animals, so then they do bring a Maaseh Behema. Why is that? Because then it's a different type of shutfah. It's trusa sabayis. Then it's considered to be like it belongs to the estate. Belonging to the estate is just like a shutfah said that is imposed on the heir, sort of, against their will. It wasn't something that they went into voluntarily. The classic example that he likes to bring is the case of paying taxes. So we know that there's a whole big hullabaloo. Are you obligated to pay taxes or not? The bottom line is, yeah, of course you're obligated to pay taxes. But why are you obligated to pay taxes? So that's a question. Is it what's the authority that the kingdom has to insist upon taxes? If you didn't pay taxes, what are you violating? The Rambam says that this is a violation of Gezeila on some level, and the Mishnah Melech says, if you simply don't pay up a loan, it's called Hafkas Milveh, that you owe money to a non-Jew and you happen to just figure out a way to get around ever having to pay him back. So that's not gezel, that's not stealing. Stealing is I take something away from somebody, but maybe, this should be okay. So obviously it's not okay, but the question is it not okay on a deraisa level to avoid paying tax, not okay on a derabbanan level? What exactly is the authority, for the government to insist that we're going to pay taxes? We assume that we have to pay taxes. Melech Mishpat Yamid Aretz said that they have the right to insist on paying on I'm charging taxes. But the whole discussion was based upon a different sort of tax than the one that we have nowadays. It used to be that the king would charge a tax because the king had to furnish the royal palace. The king wanted lots of money. It wasn't that the taxes were for the benefit of the population. The taxes were for the benefit of the king. But nowadays, says Rosh Hashanah, in a democracy, for example, the taxes are for the benefit of everybody. You're paying taxes so you can get services. You'll have police services. You'll have mail services. You'll have public schools. You'll have garbage sanitation that's collected. You'll have electricity. You'll have water. You'll have clean water. You know, all of you'll have highways that are nicely paved. Basically, all the money that you're paying, whether on a federal level, a state level, a municipal level, it's all based on there being a giant partnership. He says that the government, the IRS, they're really just the secretary. Their job is to be the secretary that's collecting everybody's dues in order to be able to furnish the services to everybody. But really, it's just a giant partnership. It's not just like people are living in Muncie that they have an obligation to contribute to the shul. Everyone is living in the country. You're living in the state. You're living in the city. You have an obligation to contribute to the common weal. Common fund of the city, in order to ensure that everybody gets services. And if you don't pay your share, it's not just that you're not paying a debt, an obligation that you owe towards the king. It's that you're stealing from all the other partners. Because if you don't pay your fair share, so everyone else is going to have to end up paying more in order to be able to make up the shortfall that's created by you not paying. So it's an outright theft of the other partners. So that's another application of basically the way in which we have these partnership associations that we may not even realize are partnership associations. Okay, but let's talk about the regular partners who come in because they have a business, you know, dealing together. So as we said, as a general rule, you're going to follow the rules of the Minhag HaSochrim, whatever are the normal business principles. And if there is a sort of a machlokis, or we know there are three different opinions as to whether there is a need for a kinyan or a kinyan works and so forth, so it's better to make sure that everything is written down and you have at least the partnership agreement, which is going to be binding according to the laws of the land. It's a very nice book that's written by a chaver of mine, who actually also, speaking of Muncie, grew up in Muncie, not too far away from myself, Rabbi Avi Marburger. He's a dayan in Lakewood. We sometimes talk to each other on the phone. And he wrote a book called Business Halacha. And in his book, Business Halacha, so he has a chapter about various partnership rules. So you can see that he's talking as a dayan, because the experience of a dayan is that you have so many disputes that come in front of the Beis Din from people who were partners and then they had a falling out at some point in time regarding the partnership. So he writes like this, a very telling paragraph at the end of his discussion regarding partnerships. I mean, it's actually even, I suppose, a little bit humorous, you know, for somebody not in the Beis Din world to get a sense as to the perspective that you develop as a seasoned dayan over time. As the laws of dividing a partnership are quite complex, this is talking about when you're dividing a partnership at the end, it is advisable to negotiate a mechanism for how the partnership will be dissolved before entering a partnership agreement. We talk about people signing a prenuptial agreement when they get married, that in the event that they get divorced, so they're going to submit their disputes to a Beis Din, or they want the Beis Din to decide a particular way. It's not because we have an expectation that everybody is going to get divorced. At least I hope not. It's because we want to just protect ourselves just in case. But he goes further than that. He says not only should it be a strategy for what's going to happen in the unlikely event that things go bad, but he says one should realize that virtually every partnership eventually sours, and it is worthwhile to have an exit strategy in place from the beginning. That I think is those are pretty strong words. So, you know, obviously he's not talking about the husband-wife partnership. God willing, you know, those should always work out. Just work out, you know, most of the time, the vast majority of the time. But in business partnerships, it's much more fragile. It's much more fragile. So one thing that comes up is when you have, for example, a business partner who did something that they weren't authorized to do with the business. As a general rule, the Aruch HaShulchan writes, and this is in source Yudalit, Siman Kufayin Vav, Sif Lamin Aleph, that when it comes to dealing with the partnership assets, usually you don't need to ask permission from the other partner if you're just handling the assets or engaging in investments and so forth in the normal course of how the business was set up. Every single business has its normal course of what's supposed to be done, what the expectations are. The chol shutav kiyori bereshus dami. And as a general rule, every single shutav is considered to be a yorei bereshus. It's considered like they are authorized to carry out whatever task they are carrying out. V'kimen shiyar bereshus, tzarek shutva lispo gam hefseid. So therefore, let's say that they make an investment that doesn't work out. Or they invest in a property and it doesn't turn out that it was the best property. They buy some clothing and it doesn't sell so well and so forth. Nonetheless, their shutav, their partner, has to absorb the loss, just like kimo shecholak imo im hayarevach, just like the shutav would be able to participate in a profit, that they would share the profit 50-50, whatever the apportionment is that they made up with each other. So too, they have to share the losses with each other, because it's understood that they have the right to do that. But that's only if the shutav is acting in the normal course. But what if the shutav messes up? The shutav does something that they didn't really have the right to do. So we had one case. I was speaking with my good friend Rabbi Avram Union earlier today. He's a dayan in the Rabbinical Council of California, and he dealt with a couple of partnership disputes that he wrote up in various Torah journals. So I told him, I'm planning to speak on this topic, and I was just rereading your articles, and I might quote you tonight. He was very excited. I was very happy that I found his articles worthwhile. They're very, very worthwhile articles. So he has one article in which he talks about how they had a case in front of them in Los Angeles where where Reuven gave the vast amount of money for the partnership enterprise, and Shimon's job was that Shimon was supposed to be the big brains behind managing the business. That was the nature of the partnership. One was the money partner, and the other was the manager, the brainy manager. And the brainy manager just walked away with all of the money. And what they had done was that they set up one business enterprise in California, and the other one, but that was just kind of like a shell office, just to have like a corporate office. And the other, where the main business was taking place, was in India. So the partner who took all of the money and was supposed to, run the business, he said, we'll split things up. I'll handle India and you handle California, and took all the money. So the partner said, whoa, what's going on over here? The money partner said, the California office is worth absolutely nothing. The India office is worth everything. And I invested $400,000 into the partnership. And based on the reasonable expectations of profit that we expected to come out of the partnership, I would have made another $100,000. You owe me $500,000. That was the claim that he made in front of the Beis Din. So the Beis Din said that obviously this was not included within the ambit of Shimon's expected responsibilities, that he would just unilaterally disband the entire business and decide he's going to split the partnership in this arbitrary and capricious fashion and take all of the money with him. In fact, there are rules, even when we speak about the duration of how long a partnership is going to last. There are rules. If you look in the Aruch HaShulchan, this is in source Chof Aleph, Simon Chof Ayin Vav Sipka Mem Gimel, Moshe Kviyas Man Einecha Me'ashutim Yuchalaks V'Kodem Mizman. That if there is a certain time that that everyone understands it will take for the business to be profitable, neither partner is allowed to pull out before that time. Or even if they said they didn't give a time frame to say, we're going to be in business for 6 months or 2 years, but they said we're going to carry out a certain business of enterprise with each other. So neither one is allowed to pull out until the ASIC is actually carried out. In this case, nothing was carried out. And this is more in the category of a shutav who was Shina, meaning the shutav acted in a fashion in which they went against the partnership interest. They went against the partnership rules and responsibilities. So you look in source test above. Again, the Aruch HaShulchan very succinctly encapsulates a lot of the rules. So that's why I quoted from the Aruch HaShulchan. Also, there's this thing with Bar Ilan CD-ROM, just like a personal frustration, that if you cut and paste, you get like all the footnotes, like the olives and the little bases and the gimels and the dollars and so forth, you have to manually delete every single one in order for it not to appear on the copy sheet. So it's just much easier to cut and paste the Aruch HaShulchan. But in any event, im echad me'ashutim shina mikol edu adrarim kon shahalach l'makom shal yelo hayelo leilech. If the partner went somewhere they weren't supposed to go, pirish b'yan kishloyelo lifosh, or macha b'hakafa kishloyelo limkar, or they sold on credit when they weren't supposed to sell on credit, and so forth, and there was a loss, as the basis of one of these things that they did, oh nishtatek imacher, or they joined up forces with somebody else, and they did it without getting permission from their shutuf, and it was something that was not in the ordinary course, what we might call ultra-virus, Ira, is that like the right word? Ultra-virus? Okay, good. Okay, just want to make sure. So any loss which is suffered, they have to pay themselves. They have to pay out of their own pocket whatever loss they caused their partner to lose.
Ultra-virus would be like if I set up an LLC,
yes,
and I have standard operating provisions under, for example, Illinois law, that LLC can conduct any lawful business. I can start it as a real estate operation and then switch it to selling shoes, unless there's what's called an ultra vires restriction in there, meaning, for example, when I set up a medical practice, the law regarding professional, what are called now PLLCs, professional liability corporations, like a medical practice or an architecture practice, a law practice, has specific language that limits that.
Then you can't go beyond those parameters. So here I'm borrowing that phrase, you know, when I'm speaking about the partners vis-a-vis each other, if that's okay. Nonetheless, if a partner veers from their partnership responsibilities, from the parameters of their jurisdiction, so to speak, then that partner can only lose but not gain, meaning that if they end up, you know, with a big windfall because they did something that was against partnership practices, they still have to share that windfall with the other party because they were using partnership assets. But if they lose because it was without any authority, so then they have to completely compensate the other. So it's very interesting if you take a look at the Nesivos in Source Yud Zayin. So the Nesivos Hamishpat, commenting on the Shulchan Aruch in Source Tes Zayin, that's in Simen Kuf Ayin Vav, many of the laws of Shutfus are in Kol Shemishpat, Simen Kuf Ayin Vav. So the Shulchan Aruch says that if one of the partners had merchandise, there was a certain season that the merchandise is supposed to be sold, and if you sell it before the seasons, it's understood you're not going to make the regular amount of profit. You're going to make less money, and it's going to be bad for the partnership. So when the season arrives, one partner can't stop the other partner and say, "Oh, I want you to wait longer because maybe we'll be able to make more money." No, this is the season, and either partner has the right, according to the partnership principles of their practice, they have the right to sell when it is the season for this merchandise to be sold. That's okay. But if one of the partners sells before the season, so then if they don't make as much profit and it ends up that they have to suffer a loss because they sold too early, so then they have to compensate the other party. But when compensating the other party doesn't only mean that they give the party the amount of money that that party invested. It also means that if that party had a reasonable expectation they were going to make 10% profit, and now because this other party sold early, the other partner sold early and didn't make the 10% profit, they have to turn over the 10% profit that would have been made to the partner. It's considered to be gross negligence. And the chaver has to get his chelek, not only his investment, but the chelek that he would have profited. So the Sefer HaMishpat says, wait a second, I don't understand this. The person should be treated as no worse than a mazik. I am a mazik. If you damage somebody's property, you only have to pay the value of the property at the time you damaged it. You don't have to pay the value of the property, what it would have been worth, if the property would have been around for another month, and now the person would have been able to sell it for more than it was worth a month earlier. No, you only pay the value what it's worth right then. Even though if we know for sure that it was going to go up in value afterwards. So how come this partner has to pay more than that? So he says that it could be that this is considered garua because he's like a kavlan, the samach nafsho alav, that it's considered to be somebody who was depending, their investment was dependent upon the commitments that you made to that individual. And the svara behind this, which he quotes from Ashita Mikubetzis in Baba Mesia, Dapayan Gilom and Base, based on our Ritva, that's quoted by the Ashita Mikubetzis, is that if a person makes an investment based on your say-so, that you're going to do something with that investment, you're going to work the land, and then you end up not working the land, and therefore the person doesn't get the crops that they would have ordinarily gotten from the land. Or you were given some money to buy some wine in a particular place where it sells cheap and you're able to, where you can buy it cheap and sell it dear, and there's no question that you'd be able to get a hold of that wine and you just don't do it. So then there's a shita, you know, Rav Chama in the Gemara Bava Metzi over there that says that you have to pay for the lost profit because you didn't buy the wine. And similar to, you know, the person who undertakes that they're going to work on somebody's field and then they just say, and then they just leave the field fallow, where there is a stipulation, that the person is obligated to pay, if they leave the field fallow, they're obligated to pay the expected, yield of crops that would have grown in that field had the person worked the field. Why is that? Why does the person have that obligation? So the Ritva explains, because it's like an Arif Kaplan. It's like you're serving, when you take on this responsibility, you're asking somebody else to dish out their property, or dish out their money, based on the assurances that you're giving them, so then you are serving as a guarantor. You're serving as a guarantor for the service that you are promising. As long as the results are pretty much assured, if you would do what you promised to do, so then you're serving as an Arif Kaplan. So therefore, the argument that Nesivas HaMishpat makes is that a partner really is undertaking that responsibility vis-a-vis the other partner. So Rabbi Union and his Bezdin in L.A., in that particular case, said that because the other party ran away with the money, and as a result, the first partner was not able to either get their money or get the expected profits on the money, and it was demonstrated to the Bezdin that it was pretty much a sure thing that the $400,000 would have turned into $500,000. So the partner that absconded and decided to unilaterally disband the partnership before the time had come was responsible to pay not only the original $400,000 but also the additional $100,000. And they actually won mechayev the person the full amount of $500,000 in that particular case. So we've had cases like, if you look, go back to the Aruch HaShulchan, of the things that you're really not supposed to do. So one of the things, if you look in source test above, from Siman Kuf Ayin Vav Sif Lamed Gimel, in the Aruch HaShulchan is Onishtate Fim Acher, V'chein Koyev Kol Kiyotzi Bo. You bring another partner into the business without consulting with the first partner. And so he said that you're changing the entire nature of the business enterprise without consulting with the first partner, and this leads to a loss, so then you have to compensate the partner for that loss as well. So we had a case where somebody went into a real estate partnership, and the nature of the real estate partnership was there was one person who was going to be buying the property, and he had, you know, various investors. And when he would rehab the property and then resell the property afterwards, he would share the profit on this property with these investors who were investing with him. So there was one investor who gave a certain amount of money towards the property, and there were some bad business decisions that were made by this person. When they started doing the rehab on the property, they didn't get the proper building permits, and they had to end up paying very exorbitant fines and redoing things and so forth. So the profit in the end, when this particular property was turned around and sold, was much less than it was expected to be if they would have, you know, done everything correctly. But much to the horror of the first investor, they also discovered, when they wanted to put a lien on the property in order to, you know, get back at their claim from what they had lost in the investment, they discovered that it wasn't so easy to put a lien on the property of this other person, because it wasn't in his name anymore. Because there was another investor that entered into the picture, and this person who, you know, had agreed to this partnership deal that he would be buying the property in his own name and turning it around, he just let this other investor take the property in there, and he transferred the property to the other investor. So the Bezdin came, so we asked, why in the world did you do that? He said, oh, well, because of the fact that I was making these commitments to the other investor, and I'd have to, you know, pay him money for his investment, and this way we would avoid interest, ribbis problems. My lawyer advised me to do this, so we would avoid ribbis problems, because this way he would own the property, and I'd be paying him rent. So he said, well, you could have done a heter iska. Like, you know, there are other ways to get around, you know, the interest problems. And if you're going to sell the property to a different person altogether without telling the first investor, that's a major shinoi. That's a major change from the original business proposition that you're just completely giving it away to another party altogether. So he said any loss that was suffered in the end in terms of the investment, the investor did get something back, but not what was the reasonable amount, had things been done, you know, properly. So he said you're entitled to the difference and you're entitled to recoup that loss from this other partner, because what the other partner did, namely the one that, you know, sold the property from himself to the second investor, was completely in violation of the parameters of the partnership. It was a shinoi. Once he did a shinoi, so if everything would have turned out rosy and it would have been a great profit, so then the original investor would have gotten the full benefit. But since there was a loss, so therefore he had to compensate the investor for the loss that occurred. So that was one of the cases that we actually had. Now, the next, you know, question becomes, well, what if you actually do have a partnership that goes sour? So if it goes sour, so how do you divide the partnership, you know, assets at the end of the day? So here we have a general principle that if the assets are easily definable and easily demarcated, that you have, for example, three parcels of land and three partners. So each partner can get, you know, one parcel of land. You figure out, you know, one is worth a little bit more than the other. So you figure out monetary differences and so forth, that you could just, you know, divide the actual assets. But sometimes you have assets that are not really so easy to split up. Like I have a real estate asset. I can't just give one person the attic and the other person the basement. It doesn't work that way. That's not comfortable. People don't, you know, split up property quite in that fashion. So we do have a principle that if something is not capable of easy chalukah, it's not capable of being split up in an easily manageable way. So we have the principle that people are familiar with of go to Ogud, right? Go to Ogud is not like the apocalypse. Go to Ogud is where you're talking about, I have two partners where it's clear that the partnership needs to be brought to a conclusion. And one partner says, I'll buy you out for the following price, that we figure out, we assess the partnership assets at a particular price. And if you don't want me to buy you out, so you can buy me out at the same price. Is that something which is considered to be viable? There's a little bit of a machlokus whether you can always say go to Agudah only when you get to the end of the partnership term where it's clearly no longer viable. We assume like the latter option. But we assume that you can say it. Where do we have go to Agud? Where do we have it codified? So if you take a look in source Chaf, the Shulchan Aruch, this is based on a sugya in Baba Basra and Daf Yud Gimel Amudeis, that is codified in Siman Kuf Ayin Aleph Sif Vav. Echem Yashukli Shema L'Chaveiro. One of the partners says to his fellow, where the partnership has come to the end of its term, where they've completed their ASIC, like their, you know, preliminary business transaction. It's a question, do we continue the partnership or not? And one says, no, I want out. And the assets aren't so easy to split. You take one and I take one. It's not kidei chalukah, what we call. But that was she'efsha she'achloku. Not going to be so neat. Like, you know, one of the more recent cases we had was where there were a bunch of nursing homes and the partners were splitting the nursing homes, and it wasn't, you know, such a neat thing to say this one will take these, this one will take those, because it was too complicated. It was too complicated in terms of you being able to, you know, make that easy division. So one partner can say to the other let me buy you out, or you buy me out. Hadini mo. So we say we allow him to do that. And we require this to be done. Even if, let's say, that the partnership assets would be evaluated at $1 million, and the person who wants to buy out the other says, you know what, I'll buy you at $3 million. He's allowed to do that. As long as he doesn't say $500,000. If he says $500,000, so you'll say, oh, well, that's, you know, pretty good, because The other fellow can just, you know, pay him $500,000. But if you know the other fellow is in dire, dire straits and he doesn't have the $500,000, yes, true, he'd be able to get it dirt cheap, but he just doesn't have the money. So then it's not fair because the one who's offering to buy out is going to take advantage of the other fellow's disadvantageous financial position in order to be able to make, cheat him out of the value of his partnership share. So therefore, it has to be at least the market value. It has to be at least the market value that is offered. It could be more than the market value, but it can't be less than the market value. Okay? So tzarach ha'shedi liknos limkor. So in such a case, the second person is obligated either to agree to be bought out or to turn around. He has the right to turn around the table and to say, I'll buy you out instead. And the Ramah gives you these the general principles of the restrictions. If you look in the Haggah, the Ramah, however, there are two principles. Principle number one is that the person who's offering good or agur has to actually have the money. You can't say, I'm going to buy you out at $1 million, and then and I'll figure out how to get the $1 million. Anyway, you can only make the offer if you actually have the $1 million. You actually have to have the money. The other fellow who is being confronted with the offer, who is being given the offer to either accept the money or to buy the other person out, is generally given a 30-day period to come up with the money because it wasn't his idea. So he has a little bit more time to come up with the money if he wants to buy out the first person instead. You can't say go to Agud if it's less than the market value, as we mentioned, for the reason that we mentioned, because otherwise, because then the rich person will take advantage of the poor person, and we certainly don't want that to happen. So then the question really becomes, what are the conditions in which one person could say it's really not working? If you have, for example, two partners, and one partner says, I really want to disband this business at this point in time, and the other one says, I think that the business could still be viable. So at one point we say that, well, they still, you know, are in the middle of their business season, and give it another year, or give it another 6 months before we disband the partnership. How can you tell if you're the Bezdin that it's time to disband the partnership? If the, you know, obviously if the partnership agreement stipulates, you know, specific parameters and terms and conditions, then you always follow the terms of the partnership agreement. Like, we had a partnership agreement where there was actually an override on the Shina, you know, provision. Because the Shina provision says, if one partner says something that wasn't, you know, properly authorized, that wasn't considered, it wasn't authorized by the other partner, it wasn't, you know, within the parameters of their responsibilities, so they have to suffer any loss. So we had a case where one person was an investor, and he made like an investment decision that was not in the normal course. It was like, you know, pressing the wrong button. It was like something along those lines. So do you say that, well, since it wasn't authorized, it wasn't nefarious, but it wasn't authorized, so many of the posts say it doesn't have to be nefarious. If it wasn't authorized, he has to suffer the loss. And this person was arguing, no, the loss should be shared equally by the two of us. And the machria, from the Bezdin's perspective, was that they had a partnership agreement that said that each party will indemnify the other one for any kind of errors or omissions or commissions that are made, as long as it's not a result of gross negligence, you know? As long as it's not, like, willful. You know, this was not willful in nature. The person was trying to do what was appropriate for the partnership, and they just made an honest error. But it clearly wasn't in the category of the person who was engaged in malfeasance. I think the standard was, you know, willful malfeasance. Clearly wasn't willful malfeasance. So you look at that as a standard. But let's say that there is no, you know, clear termination clause. So a lot of the Batei Din end up invoking the Chazon Ish. It's very, very interesting. The Chazon Ish, when he codifies a lot of the halachos, so the Chazon Ish, of course, was brilliant in terms of being able to break down the conceptual underpinnings of all the sugyas and all the rishonim and so forth and so forth. The Chazon Ish also has like a lot of very good down-to-earth practical applications of the halacha that are very relevant to Beis Din practice. So take a look at the Chazon Ish. This is in Baba Basa Simen Tes Os Dalet, in Source Chop Beis. Okay? V'mon kilkul be'esik. If you see that there is some sort of a business where things are not going well, If there's a kill call that the business is not going well and you can split it, so great. Let me skip a little bit. V'chein me'echad toveya, third line. V'chein me'echad toveya, good or agud, b'davar she'ev shalachlok, shomim lo, haya esik mabiach. But let's say that the business was not falling apart. Business was not falling apart. We have cases like this. They're making a certain amount of money. There are some challenges and problems, but the main challenge is the two partners are just not getting along with each other. That's the main challenge. And one of them, you know, might want to piggyback on, you know, whatever the other guy is doing, whatever money is being made. But, you know, one of them, at least one of them says, I can't take it anymore. They're just, there's so much at each other's throats, they're not able to live with each other in the partnership anymore. They can't take it. At least one of them can't take it. So one of them says, I want good or ugly, let me out of here. Olakok, or let's just split the assets. Sarach achra. He says, then you need achra. What does achra mean? It means Bezdin has to make a determination. How bad is the enmity? You know, how bad, you know, is the karma in the room? How toxic is the situation? He says, Havi Kanafo Beso, is this like a case where there was an investment in the house and it just collapsed? Like the Rosh says, there is one opinion that says that good or agud only works when it's, what did we say at the beginning of this year? An involuntary partnership. Involuntary partnership. So you could say, I don't want to be in this partnership in the first place. We inherited something. We got a gift that we're supposed to share something together. But you entered into it voluntarily. So there's one opinion that says you can never say good or agud. But if it's something that neither party could have expected, when they went into the partnership, like they didn't expect that they're going to have a falling out. They didn't read Rabbi Marburger's book that said that every single partnership is going to, you know, end in disaster. So they didn't realize that there's going to be a parting of ways in the middle. So then maybe Matzi Tai and Good Oagun, Tamanas Kelo Nishtabe, because they never went into the partnership with this expectation, Oh Sinalav Tainahi. Or do you say alternatively that no, hatred is not a good enough reason if they're making good money. So, generally speaking, when the Beis Din adjudicates these cases, we come to the conclusion that sin is a pretty good reason to break up the partnership. Because, you know, even if right now they're making good money, if they're not getting along, things are probably not going to remain rosy, you know, that much longer. So get out while you're ahead. Always a good thing to say, it's always good or ugly when you're ahead, right? You know, good to get out when you're ahead. Yes, Ira.
Question. So, going back to the... And I guess this would exclude a partnership like a Balim in a city or something, but see, Reuven, Shimon, and Levi each inherited from a father, or they were shareholders, and they each, you know, inherited the sum of 100% of a business assets. And Levi just says, forget it, I don't want to be in this business. In Illinois estate law, let's say it's an inheritance, you can disclaim the inheritance. I don't want to be part of this. I hereby disclaim my interest, and that interest would get folded back equally to the remaining heirs. Does halakha have such a thing to avoid these kinds of forced partnerships?
You could, if you're inheriting, you could always take your portion and give it to somebody else. It's a general rule, but you can't refuse an inheritance in the first instance. It's kind of interesting. A bechor can reject his double portion because of the fact that the Torah uses the lashon of nesina. Now, with respect to the double portion of a bechor, it's one which is kind of based on the person taking it as a matana. But if they don't take it, it says losis lo pishnayim, right? So therefore, you can refuse a matana. But your general yerusha just is what we call memela. That comes to you whether you like it or not. So it does create, at least in the first instance, you can't really get out of it. Then it becomes a question of just assigning it to somebody else.
So practical example that happens a lot, you know, the children will inherit from the father or the mother, and one of the children, let's say they're either disabled or they're getting social security disability or they're getting some other benefit for their education or something, and that yerusha will knock them out of eligibility. So they make a calculated decision. They don't want to inherit. They don't want the money because they would rather have the continuing benefit.
Right.
Than
so
the
in halakha, you cannot refuse the money in the first instance. You get the money. You might be able to do something after you have it, but you have the money in the first instance. Yes, it's kind of interesting. It doesn't work the same way, except for the double portion of the bechor. So I just conclude another very interesting case we had is that you have two partners. So generally speaking, to the rest of the world, they kind of operate together. So if you pay one partner, let's say that you borrowed money from a partnership, and you pay one partner, so the halakha is, that's a source of Chaf Gimel over here, Shulchan Aruch Hilchos Shutfim Siman Kuf Ayin Vav, Misha Hoda Lechem Yashutfim, no Par Lechem Yam, Kidu Hodu Par Lechutfo. If you pay one of the partners, it's considered as if you paid the other partner as well. We had one case where there was a partnership that apparently was unraveling, but the rest of the world didn't know that they were unraveling. They were like, they were food purveyors. They were providing food to various establishments. And one of the people, one of the two partners came to one of the food establishments and said, oh, instead of making the check out to the partnership, from now on, just make it out to me. So they made it out to the other guy and to this guy, and then he absconded with all the money because basically the partnership was unraveling. And then the other partner came along and said, hey, where's my money? And the food establishment said, well, we paid the other guy. So the halakha is that if you paid one of them, it's as if you paid both. But what the Shulchan Aruch really means is that when you pay one guy, that guy has to share whatever amount he received with his partner, and he shouldn't assume that it only went to him. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the person who paid one guy is off the hook from paying the other guy. That really relates to some other halakhas. You look in the Shach, Sif Kafei over here, and Siman Kaf Kafeis. The Shach says that, as a general rule, let's say I have somebody who's a representative of a company, and they used to be a representative, but they're not a representative anymore. So the Shach says that it could be that they're not a representative anymore as far as the company is concerned, but if the third parties were not told this information and the third party relied upon this person being the representative, then they can't be harmed as a result of it. So here, the third party had a good reason to assume the partner was still the partner and was representing not only himself, but also representing the other party, and therefore they presumably couldn't be made to pay double. On the other hand, in this particular case, they really should have been on the lookout a little bit. It was a little suspicious that the fellow said, oh, don't make the check out to the company, make it out to me personally. That's the last source that I have in the Aruch HaShulchan, Siman Ayin Zayin, that says that if for one partner comes along and he has a note, he has the shtar, he has the promissory note, so then when you're paying the person with the promissory note, you can assume it's for both of them. But if he's not coming with a promissory note, and the other person has the promissory note, then the other person really has the right to assume his chelek. So here, you know, one partner said, I'm not telling you to make it out to me personally, make it out to my company. The other fellow was telling you to make it out to him personally. It was as if he was not presenting the promissory note, you know, that and therefore whatever you paid him was only good for his share, but you should have to pay me my share as well. And we said that that was not a bad argument, therefore we allowed for an additional payment. We did authorize an additional payment to the other partner on that benefit, not the full payment, because we felt that the other partner sort of knew that his sidekick was not behaving so well and should have anticipated that he might pull these types of shenanigans and should have pulled the plug in the partnership earlier. So we made like a little pshara, and we allowed for and we authorized payment of one third of the chelek that belonged to the other partner, even after the entire amount had been paid to the previous person. Okay, that's just a little bit of a sampling of some of the laws and some of the cases of shutfos, and we'll stop here.